Channel 2 over. Continuation of visit with Miss Mary, with Debbie and Faye. Rick's not here this Saturday after lunch, the 27th of January, 73. Channel 2 over. And beginning a continuation of visit with Miss Mary, with Debbie and Faye this Saturday, the 27th of January, 73.
And very seldom a shirt.
That's right.
Oh. He lives right below, down in the coast, not far from his name. She's never seen anybody rack up the bait. That's something. Have you done that, Miss Mary?
I have a little bit. Not much.
How do they do? Rack it up?
We'll show you. But that's what they do all the time, is fish.
Miss Ross, I believe I want to use your bathroom.
Okay, you know where it is.
And I expect I better get back to the house.
Yes.
You need to say nothing. You've got to go full of time.
I'm ready. I'm willing. How to talk. Solid.
I would. She wanted to see the new horse, because he's a new horse. How big it was. I told her I was going to ride Molly over. I said I didn't know if Molly could make it that far, and she said that Mr. Guthrie used to ride 10 times that far every day on his horse when he'd go out hunting cattle. If Molly can't make it that far, she's not much of a horse.
Well, that's what I thought about. You could have taken your horse over there. Uh-huh. But see, it takes so long to get going. See, she works in the morning. She don't work most of the day. That's been my trouble. You see, catching them when they're right. I brought this out just because I had something in there. Ham shimpers.
You want green?
Yeah.
That's a good fish. Mm, yeah. And that's a new.
Solid tone. Huh?
Mm-hmm. I wish we could find out how to do this.
Wait, let me just hold up just a minute. Solid tone.
Everything from politics to...
Is that out of the sales people?
I looked at the roof.
You don't know the points of it, could you?
No.
I'll show you some of the points. Where do we go? Babe?
Yeah.
Let me get you. You want to go? Yeah. I'll go.
You go.
She'd rather you go.
No,
go.
No.
Go to your.
No.
You are more.
He
died. Be nice not to for a while.
You trying to take it off and have it?
Yeah.
Okay, get ready. Let me see. Could you give me a cue? Okay.
You can talk about her Marvin's brother's wife. What she did the other night.
I've been dying.
Don't know.
Hadn't seen her?
Haven't seen her, haven't heard a word from her.
Let me tell you. I was over there, you know the day, and that little boy she got for me,
mm-hmm.
she gonna have to butcher that bull. Did you know that?
Well, she told you that told her that it would be best for her too.
See, she got the prettiest bull here I had, Patrick, and he was just he'd leave all the others and come on up there. I can see him right now, just a little fella. Right there, halfway up the back lane, just standing there looking at me to see if I was going to give him a hand out. And he'd come right up there.
I believe it. That bull was hurt. I'll always believe it.
Well, it certainly had no symptoms over here.
Mm-mm.
He was.
You know, I don't know whether you know it or not, but I think you do, that Mr. Dodd, he is not kind with animals at all, and Johnny's just like him.
Yeah.
If they have to do something that they don't want to do, they're ready to kill it. And I do know some things, I don't know that he done that, but I know some things he done.
Well, you can hurt an animal.
Huh?
You can hurt an animal.
Why, you can pick up a stick and hit a cow in the side and it'll kill her. Mr. Guthrie always told Marvin to be very careful and not hit a cow in the side with a stick.
Yeah.
Too easy, he said, to kill. And I just believe that bull was hurt. I told Miss Dodd so. I said, that bull was hurt, Miss Dodd. I said, that bull didn't have no pneumonia. Not that long.
And couldn't get over it.
Couldn't get over it and still got it. You know he didn't have pneumonia. And she said he'd foam, you know, at the nose. Well, that shows that he was hurt inside some way or another. And that cow that was butchered over there, you know,
I don't know
nothing. That veterinary butchered that day.
Yeah.
And that veterinary said that cow had a heart attack.
Yeah.
Shoot, that yearling just to show was hurt.
Yeah.
Don't you know if it had a lick across the heart, hard enough to kill it, that it would make his heart discolored. He didn't know, that vet didn't no more know what that guy died with than I did, I don't believe. They
well,
don't.
No. Well, I'm tell you, I've had trouble over here. These cows, you know, if you let them get ahead of you, it's hard to break them.
Yeah.
And I had these yearling heifers. There's one of them out there that was my friend. Every time I'd go out, she'd speak to me. Well, it's all right for a while, you see. But then all the rest of them picked it up. And I couldn't hardly get out of the house. I'd have to go the front way. And, well, you hate to just knock the fire out of them.
Yeah. I don't do it.
I put her in that corral.
I got one at home that's old. She's sharp horn. Her horns are so sharp and she just fights. I may be doing wrong. I may be getting myself in trouble, but I'm going to send her off. You know what it costs? They charge you to sell a cow for a veterinary to test her? $4.
Yeah.
But at that market.
That comes off your ticket. Well, let me tell you, I got me a little old stick to them, but it's all rotten. And these little palm fronds, you know, you can hit them and pop them, and then you get the palm leaves, and you can just knock the fire out of them.
That's the way I do when we go to load them. I get me a cabbage palm leaf,
yeah.
And I scare the fire out of them and make them go up in.
But that doesn't hurt.
No, ma'am, that don't hurt.
Well, now that's what I got after her. And she just run around there and duck her head and get in the corner, you see. And I'd whack her with that paddle, you see, and all like that. She thought she'd been killed.
Mm-hmm.
It done just as much good as the two before.
That's right.
And then I hit her on the rump.
Mm-hmm.
And on the nose. Now, maybe that's not the proper place, the nose.
No, I don't like to see anybody hit a cow on the nose. Me and Morgan's had more ups and downs about that. I don't let him hit him on the nose with that. But now, then they're little cabbage palms, like you say. That don't hurt. But if you hit him with that stick, that will hurt.
Oh, it will. Oh, it will.
Well, I want to tell y'all something. This is a secret. And I don't want nobody else to know it. But I don't know where I sold my place or not.
Miss Mary?
That's right. I got a letter from my lawyer last night. And Scott wanted him to write to me and see if I would extend 90 days longer.
And I tell you what Tricord told me. He says you were just giving it away. He says you got $1,000 just as easy.
You can't do no such a thing, Mr. Miles, for that many acres.
There's more acres, the more you can get.
Well, he wrote me a letter, and I'm not going to extend the time.
Hey, don't extend it, then. Just get it back and let him sell it again for you. Get a Swicord working for you.
I ain't going to do it. I don't want to have nothing to do with Swicord. You know what he done? He went down yonder to the woods and tried to rent that land to Fred Woods for watermelons this year. And Fred Woods come to my house, and I said, I don't know how in the world Swicord went to you and tried to rent my property to you for watermelons. And I said, you better not. I said, Swicord ain't got nothing to do with that, nor Scott ain't either. That's still my property. I paid taxes on it, and ain't been no papers exchanged. And I said, that's still my property, and if you don't believe it, throw Fred Woods. I said, you call up Adney Adkins and ask him who it belongs to.
Yeah.
And he's been all over the country, and he went somewhere else and tried to rent it to somebody else for something, but I can't remember now what it was. He ain't got no business going all over the country trying to rent that place.
Well, now that's a little surprising.
Well, he did it. Fred come up to the house.
See about it?
Just before he went to Miss Dodd's, and I told him no. I said, Swicord, you can't get that from Swicord. That belongs to me.
And Swicord didn't say anything to you about it?
He might even see him.
You know, he got a divorce.
Who?
Swicord.
When?
Since you seen him.
Is that right?
And he says the judge couldn't understand it. He told the judge, he said the judge was the sort of fella, he liked to help people patch up their troubles, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And he got to telling Swicord, you know, that he might just be, not be so hasty about this thing. And Swicord talked to him, and he told the judge, why, he says, since I've got this divorce, I'm just about to get it. Me and my wife is getting along better than we ever did before. And he says the judge looked at him as if he didn't understand what he's talking about. But you'd understand.
No, I wouldn't be there, because, you know, I don't know nothing about nothing like that.
Yeah.
Well, I'm not going to extend the time. The time will be up in March.
Well, that's coming. That's not long.
And he ain't getting out. Now, I understand that he went to work and bought all that Simonson Ranch.
That same fella?
Same fella, and he's bought up, I don't know what all. Now, Freddie Woods told me he knows all about it.
Yeah.
And his daddy did, too. Well, he told me, he wrote Mr. Adkins a letter, and Mr. Adkins sent it to me. Well, it's bad that anybody can't meet their obligations, but I've got to meet my obligations, too.
Well?
And it'll soon be time for me to go over there and plant cow feed or do something with it. And if I can't get my money out of it, well, the deal is off.
Yeah, but you don't have much labor now over there.
Well, I've got grass over there.
Yeah. As I understand it, they paid $1 million for that Simon Ranch. $1 million.
Mm-hmm.
Gee,
well,
I don't know how big it is.
If he don't come up with my money, I'm going to see Miss Dadkins Monday. And I'm going to tell Miss Dadkins that the deal is off.
Yeah.
If my money don't come up. In March. That's right.
Well, now, if he got all that Simon Ranch, he don't care about this little old piddling amount of land you got.
No.
Why, they got 2 or 3 sections, 3 or 4, I don't know how much. I don't know how much they got over there. That's what Swicord said to me one day. Forget where it was.
Well, he sure has changed his tune.
What did he say to you?
He told me and Marvin that that was a good price. And I asked Mr. Adkins and Mr. Adkins' attorney what they thought about it. And we was private by ourselves, too, and they said they thought that was a good deal. See? I'm supposed to get 55% over what they pay me. If they sell it for $1,000 or $2,000 an acre, or a half an acre for $1,000, I'm supposed to get 55% of it.
Oh.
Above what they pay me for it.
Oh, you've and got that sort of
thing. Now, that's the way it's sewed up. And I asked Mr. Atkins about it, and Mr. Atkins said, you sure got a good income.
Not bad, Jim. I get you to sell my property.
And Mr. Atkins told him, says, now, if you all miss one payment on this, he says, I'm going to foreclose on you. He says, I'm taking it back. And he told him, see, I got so much laid up in escrow. And he told him, he says, if you don't take it, you don't get this money back. Says he gets it. I don't know what they're going to do about that. But I believe that they'll come across that. I think they just want to put me off, but they ain't going to do it. I'm just going to tell Mr. Adkins I'm going to make an appointment with him Monday, and I'm going up there to see him. And I'm going to just sit down and tell him just that I just ain't going to do it.
Tell you what.
That's 3 months.
Mm-hmm. He sure it is.
And that would knock you out of the cow feet and putting in your pasture.
Well, sure, and I went and spent all my money that I could get a hold of and buy a fence post and wire and fenced it out. And
That's right.
Got it ready for them, and of course they went in there and surveyed it, but they didn't have to do. I didn't make them do it. I told them I weren't going to do it.
Yes, sir, you got that fence up just in time. Well, they'd have to...
Another man over there in Gainesville called Marvin I don't know how many times and wants it to set out peach trees.
Oh, really?
Doctor, somebody from the university.
Yeah.
And the last time he talked to Marvin, he asked Marvin, he says, well, would you mind if I call you again? Marvin says, call me anytime you want to. And I think he's kind of in hopes that these people won't take it and he can buy it from me.
Mm-hmm.
And he'll buy it.
That's what I think. Now, I don't know. He didn't say it in them words. But that's what I think.
Yeah. Well, it'd be nice to sell to him.
And he asked Marvin, he says, if these people don't take it, would you consider selling it to me? And Marvin said, I sure would, just as soon sell it to you as anybody.
Yeah. We better get them greens, hadn't we?
Yes, sir.
Before somebody along the line might change their mind. I declare, you look a lot perkier than you did the other day.
I am lots perkier.
Do you think it's the weather?
I just think it's just time I wore that flu out.
Well, I can remember time after time. I'd catch a cold or the flu early in the year, and I'd have it clear on up to Valentine's.
That there Farm Mutual man that runs that store over there at Gainesville told us yesterday, he said his wife had been sick way before Christmas. And said some days, she says, well, I've got it licked. And said that night she'd have a chill and the fever would come on her and she'd be just as bad off as ever.
Yeah.
Well, that's just exactly the way I was.
All that time. Well, I certainly am glad to see you feeling yourself again.
And your animals are all pretty good shape?
Fairly. We ain't had no little calves yet.
Well, you're going to have to re-fertilize.
You gonna let me have some money?
I want to put all I got in this hole.
In your rock?
Yeah.
Well, that's the trouble.
That old hole just won't grow.
Oh.
Channel 2 over, around 300 or 400. End of the visit with Miss Mary, with Debbie, Rick's not here, and Faye. This Saturday, 27th of January, 73. Channel 1 over, around 300 or 400. And the end of the visit with Miss Mary, with Debbie, and Faye. Rick's not here. This Saturday, the 27th of January, 73.
You got there with your breakfast on your arm.
Yeah, I walked in at 8:20 in the morning with my little box of total cereal and my little.
You just pick out the things, the few of the things you want. I have to go with the whole thing. Just pick out a few of the nice ones.
Well, while we were having coffee, Miss Mary had got to talking about watching the news. Well, she wasn't watching the news, but she'd been watching the news, and she said to me,
"Well, she has that radio on."
She watches. Well, she either watches. She watches the television all the time too. That's what it is.
Oh, gotcha.
Because she said to me, she said that, you know, it really got next to me that President Johnson died. That really got next to me. I wish that he'd lived one more day so he could have seen peace. She said, seen the peace signed. And I said, yes, that was too bad. And she said, and President Truman too. That was so sad. But there was, but then she talked about the funerals. And she said that she thought President Truman had the most beautiful funeral she'd ever seen, because it was on a little sort of park outside, and she said she thought that was nice. It was just simple and nice.
Or they didn't go to Washington and all like that.
They didn't. Well, she said another thing she said was that in President Johnson's funeral, they had that black horse walking in the parade, and she wondered why did they have that black horse and nobody riding him. And then she decided that it was probably because that was President Johnson's favorite horse, and that's why he was there.
Yeah.
And so she said that, and you think about it, there's President Johnson is dead, and President Truman, and President Eisenhower, and President Kennedy, and then you just think about it, all their wives are still alive. And I said, yes, that's right, they were.
Well, there is something awkward about that, isn't there?
Well, it's a fact you can't get around.
And healthy, apparently. Well, Miss Truman, not so agile.
But they're all there. And then she said, did I know that President Truman was vice president when President Roosevelt was president? And I said, no, I'd forgotten that. And she said, but President Roosevelt was the best president we'd ever had, and she knew it because President Roosevelt was the one that had brought them electricity. And President Roosevelt was the one that built the road in front of their house, and Marvin Townsend, and she listed about four or five other people who'd worked on the road, and that was so that they could make money. And she talked a lot about all the banks closing, too, all the banks in Gainesville and McIntosh and Micanopy, the Depression, and President Roosevelt stopped that, too. So she knew he was a good president. And then she started, Marvin went out to work in, he's building a cow pen, and so Miss Mary and I stayed in the kitchen, and Miss Mary started cooking, and she talked and cooked the whole time. All these stories that she told me were just sort of against the background of her cooking all the time, and she never measured a thing. She just got out the bowls and poured in the flour, and she made the biscuit dough and made the biscuits, and still had enough flour in the bottom of the bowl to flour the chicken and fry the chicken. And I thought I was just going to learn how to make biscuits, but it turned out to be biscuits and hush puppies and fried fish and fried chicken, all for lunch. And oh, and she made some tea too, made in a jar. And fried them all up in the big pot in hog fat. I asked her what she was frying them in, and she said hog fat, but you could use corn oil too. But she liked hog fat best, but she couldn't have it very much because of her blood pressure. But it was the best, even though you could use corn oil sometimes.
Have you ever seen anybody make biscuits like she did?
No, she made a loaf out of the dough, and then she'd pick it up like it was a little kitty or something, and squeeze it through her forefinger and her thumb, and the dough would come up on top of her fist in a little ball, and she'd take that ball out, and then she'd just roll it while she was talking to me into a little ball, and then she'd have the ball of dough in her palm, and she'd hit it with the edge of her other hand, make an X in the middle of it, and then she'd flatten it out and put it down on the skillet. And she cooked them on a skillet with a handle, not in a baking tin or anything like that, on a skillet. She put plenty of grease on the skillet, and then she put plenty of butter on top of each biscuit. Oh, they were so rich. Gosh.
Did she just put the flour? Yeah, just put the flour in until she got the dough the way she wanted it?
Well, no, she just sifted flour, and then she just took out the lard can and got a spoonful of lard and put that, not lard, but Crisco, and put that in, and then she just sat and talked to me and poured in milk. And I guess she must have put some soda or something, or unless it was self-rising flour, and just stirred away while she was talking to me. But she didn't stir enough. I mean, she did it so skillfully that she still had flour in the bottom, because she'd flour each biscuit before she put it on the pan. It was
really
something to see. Yeah. And then when she made hush puppies, she just asked me if I liked hush puppies, and I said yes, and she made them. I mean, I was just making conversation. I mean, I was just responding to her. And she made it, and I said, what do you put in hush puppies? And she said, well, for hush puppies, you need an onion. That's all she said. You need an onion for hush puppies. I have to go get an onion. So she went to the refrigerator, and she got a little onion and an egg and some ketchup, and she came back with these all in her hand. And she just tossed the meal in and chopped up the onion and tossed in some ketchup and threw in an egg, and there was still some ketchup in the bottom of the bottle, so she got some water in it and shook it up and threw that in too, and stirred up the best hush puppies I've ever had.
That was just delicious. How'd she do them in the pan?
She just got a big tablespoon and took a tablespoonful of the dough and just turned them into the fat. She didn't shape them. The dough was too wet and sticky.
And talked
the whole time. I got all the family history. I heard about her, the little boy that she brought up for Annie Bookwright, and then I heard about her son and his accident and his subsequent murder, and then I heard about she said that she was just talking about families, and she said that it was nice that she and Marvin had never had any trouble about their people accepting them when they got married. They were so used to Marvin anyway. He'd been there 35 years, and they called him Uncle Marvin anyway. But she had a friend. She had a friend on the Suwannee River. This she really liked to go catfishing with this friend, and she was going to go down there and go fishing, and we'd really have some fish then. And she said this friend Louise lived down on the river with her husband Whitey, but they used to live over here in Micanopy. But Louise's son ran him out of that beautiful house that Louise built for her son. Just ran him out because his mother got married again, and that was because the son thought that Whitey was just marrying her for what she had, not because he liked her. And Whitey was so good to her. He was so good to her, and that son never saw it. And here was this beautiful house in Micanopy, and he just ran him out. He was so mean. You know what he did? He after they got married, he went out in the cemetery and got the tombstone off his father's grave and stuck it up in the house.
That is something. I've never heard
I think he's dug it up outside their bedroom door. Well, that was has a little much for me. it surely was.
She has some right notable touches to her son that got.
Well, Miss, she has this fascination with grisly details, you might say. Miss Mary seems to be very interested in the grisly part of it. She told me all about his accident, and then he was up in the hospital with his feet in traction, and his poor little feet just got black and shriveled up and tiny until they either fell off or, no, they were cut off, I guess. And then he was in a cast from his neck to his feet for a year after that, and his wife was just awful, and finally left him because she wanted all the insurance money in one big lump, and her son knew that. James knew that he'd still get it if they'd keep paying him if he didn't ask for it all at once. And so his wife left him and wanted a divorce until one night she came back, and the next thing you knew, James was shot in the head. And nobody ever questioned his wife, and Miss Mary couldn't understand why nobody ever questioned her, except maybe it was because she was so drunk that night they couldn't. Oh, it was so crippling. Oh dear.
and they really shot him.
Oh yes, well, according to Miss Mary, his brains were all all over the living room.
Oh.
Here we are.
Oh. And I just said, well, that's too bad. There wasn't too much I could say after that, but
I like the clothesline.
Somehow I was never really quite sure how it happened until we were sitting in the car coming over here, but Miss Mary ended up coming back over to the ranch with me because she'd wanted Rick to come to lunch, and so she called over here and found out that Rick had gone to a horse sale today. And so she said that to Marvin, and Marvin said, she said to Marvin, he's gone to a horse sale. I wonder if he's going to buy a horse. And Marvin said, well, why didn't he come over here? I'd have given him one. So then we got to talking about horses, and they were asking about Cookie's horses over here, if we still had those big horses in the front pasture. And then they asked about Cookie and how was he and how's his health. And I said, well, they'd sold one of the horses. And they now had this great big 17-hand-high horse that you had to get up on with a ladder. And Miss Mary said, she sure would like to see that horse. And I said, well, come on, get in the car, and we can go over and see him. And she said, all right. Which kind of knocked my head.
Well, you see, that's what happens when Faye and I go over there. And by a half hour, I get all my bundle full, you see, all I can hold, and I don't think. And she is so disgusted, you see, when she sees you coming, she expects you to stay half a day or leave.
Well, you know, when she first knew Mother, she said, now you just bring your mother over and she can just sit with me all day. That's the way that is it.
Yeah. And that's what you should have done.
But it was over here that she got into the fish, the game warden.
That clothesline.
Oh, the clothesline.
Oh, and so she said she thought she better change her clothes to go visiting. And I said, no, she didn't have to change her clothes. She'd come on and get in the car. And she said, well, she better put on another shirt because it was cold outside. So she put on another shirt and she combed her hair straight up. And then we walked out of the house and said goodbye to Marvin and got outside. And she looked back, and Marvin had hung up the clothes that morning, and there were a pair of pants of hers on the line. And she said, oh, I bet they're dry. I better go change them because here I have a rip in these pants. It's about a foot long. And so she went over the clothesline. She felt them. She yelled at me, yeah, they're dry. And she took them off and dropped one pair and put on the others and came and got
right
them.
Right out the clothesline. Now you see, they see things that I've never seen.
No, I guess not. No.
Right there.
They sure were interested in what Rick was doing.
Rick was starving.
Rick should have been there to have some of it. Miss Mary really wanted you to come and eat.
Yeah.
He really did.
That would have pleased her.
She was disappointed there was only one person showing up. She expected at least two or three.
Yeah.
She was just disappointed that it was just me.
Yeah. Well, let's see. Well, now, how was her talk over there against the way she talked over here?
Well, it was about the same, I guess. I liked this. She told the story about the game wardens over here that with dried up hogs heads in the back seat of the car. That's, we got that.
I had never heard that before.
That's pretty good. I mostly just let her talk, just let her tell me what stories she wanted to. I didn't try to. I mean, the only story I'd even heard before was, well, I guess I knew about her son a little bit, but about the roofing.
Oh, you didn't tell us about her, about Julia.
Well, Miss Mary said to me at one point while I was sitting there, she said, what would you do if we were all sitting around like this, and all of a sudden I threw my hands in the air and I started shaking them and crying and screaming and telling you all these terrible things about Marvin. And I said, and really telling bad things about Marvin. And I said, well, I don't know, Miss Mary. I don't know what I'd do. And she said, well, the other day, Marvin's brother Preston called up and he said that you all come up and sit a while with us. And so after supper, we went up and we were all sitting around talking. And all of a sudden, Julia, Marvin's brother Preston's wife, started throwing up her hands and screaming and crying and carrying on and telling us all these terrible things that Preston had done and how he'd done all these bad things to her. And Preston was just sitting there holding his head. And I didn't know what to do. I didn't know whether to creep out of the room or what to do. I didn't know what to do. And all of a sudden, I just had enough. So I turned over to her and I said, Julia, just shut up. Just shut up. And Julia said, well, I knew you were going to take sides in this. And Miss Mary said, I'm not taking sides at all. I'm not taking sides, but I know Marvin, and I know enough about Marvin to know that if Preston's his brother, anything he did to you, you deserve, so just shut up. And she did.
Well, I didn't know Julia was nervous, temperamental.
Well,
I don't know anything about her.
She must be.
Well, you know, when I was there, she told that again.
Mm-hmm.
And she started out by saying they fight all the time. And this just goes on and on and on.
Oh, she did say that. They did.
Mm-hmm. And she said
that
just nearly everybody over there fought all the time.
Oh. Yeah. Now, Debbie, now here's one thing you could get from your reading.
and carried over. The, you see, say in Moby Dick, you see, you watch, not the best case, but you watch, what is it? What is Benito Cereno about? I can't get a hold of it. Let me see. You just watch. You just watch anyone you see go to pieces, and you see he can look at that whale at the side of the Pequod, and watch the sharks just take it away. Now that's that is, they can look at evil. They can look at things that are not nice. They look at those just as well as they look at something pleasant. In all of these, Mr. Weaver does the same thing. All of them do. The only ones who don't are educated people. They just skip the other.
Mm-hmm.
They skip it. They assume it, but I don't know that they assume it or what happens. I don't know. Now, when they started skipping it, I don't know. You want a rehearsal? You don't need a rehearsal.
I'd say Cookie has done a fine job on his truck. Because it runs good. You get on the highway with that 18-foot horse trailer, run 80 miles an hour, and it doesn't shake. I guess it was 80. The speedometer hangs up at 62, and it won't go any further. So he just pushes down the pedal until he gets going about as fast as he wants, which is fast enough to pass everything on the highway. Then he just settles right there, and away you go. And he's got a big box of Muriel cigars beside him. Awful. And he reaches in and grabs a handful, puts two in his pocket and one in his mouth, and lights up with elbow on the steering wheel, and I'd keep reaching my hand over. And he would just kind of push my hand away and light a cigar. And he got the windows down and the heater on, and he's just blowing through there, and then he's got his two-way radio on, crackling, you know, and you every once in a while you hear a voice kind of come through. So we went to Ocala like that, and along with that we had eight-track tape player on, and we listened to the Southland Gospel Bluegrass Boys sing about, "I wish I was dead, because then I'd be with Jesus." All the way to Ocala. We pulled up there, and it was an auto auction place, and I thought, my God, he's going to buy a truck before we go sell the horse. Well, it turns out he's helping this guy who runs the auto auction work out a deal where he can sell horses, too, and tack, and maybe vegetables, or anything else you can find out that you want to sell. We were the only ones there. And he went in and talked to the fellow, and the fellow, tall man, very sharp-cut features, and very bright, clear eyes, and his hair was all greased down and combed back. He had on these maroon double-knit pants and this white shirt. And I got to looking around, and I thought how dressed up he was. And the lady behind the desk had this nice electric typewriter, and she was all dressed up. And everybody else was pretty well dressed except me. And I hadn't shaved, I had this old stained shirt. I got to feeling pretty crummy. Well, he's back there painting this wall, see? And it was a blue wall with little handprints all over it, and he was painting it kind of a flesh color brown or something. Not a spot of paint on him. I wouldn't even get near paint with clothes on. He's just painting away up on this ladder with this roller and this brush. Never drop on him. And Cookie went in and talked to him, and he said, "Well, I advertised on the radio and stuff, but I missed Q and didn't do it in the shopper, the little paper. So I don't know what we'll have today. So he shook his head, and we went on out and got Sam out of the trailer. I guess it was Sam. Cookie doesn't know. He just calls him Sam. And put that saddle on him. Well, Cookie just grabs the saddle and totes it over. And I finally took it from him and put it on the horse. And then he had that bright red halter on. We put that beautiful bridle on, that shiny bit. And Cookie got on him right away. And he pranced around a little bit, and then he got off. This is, I wish Franklin was here. You could work him out. And he looks at me, and he says, you think you could? He's quick. And I said, all right, Cookie's not fast enough for me. So I hopped on. Well, he was pretty fast. And he was awful fidgety after running that trailer. So we galloped around for a little while at his command, and then I finally reined him in. And about that time, this other fellow drives up in this Ford pickup, blue and white, and a factory-made blue and white trailer, same size as Cookie's, only it was a gooseneck kind. It's got the hitch that just it arcs out like a flying buttress and lands in the middle of the bed. And, oh, those things handle nice. You talk about, he just pulled in just as smooth, as slick as it could be, and he had three horses on there, and Cookie looked over and says, I'll be damned if he's not the biggest crook you ever saw. He's a bigger crook than I am, and I tell you, that's saying something. So he said, just walk Sam out a little bit. I'll go talk to this fellow. Well, he was a long, lanky fellow, thin as a pencil, and bow-legged, from riding horses, it looked like. And they all had on Stetson hats, and I thought, oh my gosh, I've miscued again. I don't have a hat on. And they're all just as clean cut as they could be. And Cookie tried to get a haircut before we went down there.
No.
Yes. He stopped over by Yon's barbershop there in McIntosh. He looked at me and said, oh, too many. Let's go. I'll just forget about it. And this fellow steps out, and he was all dressed up in kind of a yellow pants, and his son had on maroon pants and this bright blue and white striped shirt and a little hat, too. And his son was only about 2 or 3 feet high. I guess he was under 10 years old. And he pulled out his three horses. And I got to thinking, Cookie didn't have such a bad horse after all. One of these guys' horses looked nice. It looked kind of like Missy, except it was 12 years old. And the withers was just a big mountain. I thought maybe it was part camel. And I noticed he saddled him up right away. And his saddle sat right on that lump. Uh-huh. And then he had a white mare. It was the homeliest looking horse I have ever seen in my life. Just as mule as it could be around the face. And the front legs came down, and they just swung way out to the hoof, and the hoof looked like great big spoons. Noopy has got no trouble with her feet, let me tell you. The leg just curved up like that. Mm-hmm. So Cookie went over and talked to him a while. And he looked at their horse. He said, what you want for him? He's looking at the white one. He said, oh, about $90. Cookie thought. He looked over at me and says, you watch it, I'll buy him for $75. He walked back to the fellow and says, well, you thinking about selling him anywhere? And he said, well, I was thinking of taking him to Winston. That's in Georgia. And Cookie said, well, they don't buy white horses up there. In fact, they take one look at those eyes and nobody even talk to you anymore. And the fellow shook his head and said, I guess you're right. He came back over, and I just walked the horse around, and this fella got on his and walked his out. And we had some other people come showing up about that time. We had a fellow who rents ponies for parties and things. He had it looked like a great big, 2-ton truck or something. Like maybe one of these trucks you'd rent for moving, a short moving truck or something. And he had it full of ponies, and one of them was the fattest little pony I've ever seen. His short legs and his belly was just a little ways off the ground. And they'd put these great big saddles on him, and these big, tall, lanky men would get on him, and they'd have to swing their legs out so they wouldn't drag the ground. And they'd trot them around and work them out. And they'd bring these other horses off, and the more horses they brought, the worse they looked. And they had one horse there, who I swear, one eye was lower than the other. And they were kind of looking off in different directions. Old and withered, the thing was just the saddest horse I've ever seen. And Cookie would just beam. He'd look at his horse, And I look at the horse and I thought, how remarkable. Cookie's horse is looking so much better all the time. Well, then the pack truck shows up. And it's another one of these trucks with a great big body on the back. He opens it up and he's got a shop in there. He's got shelves along the side. And he's got bridles in here and reins in here and brushes in here and these big cardboard, sheets of cardboard with a grooming kit on it, and then it's covered with plastic. And it's got a brush and a little thing for cleaning the hooves and an awl for cutting the hooves down and another kind of brush and a comb. And then he's got a thing of belt buckles, and he says to Cookie, you think you can sell any belt buckles? Cookie goes, well, I don't know. I'm working at the university right now. I thought, he's not working at the university. So I could look around, maybe find out. I don't want to take any right now, though. He says, well, you know, you sell them for $2.50. You're doubling your money. Shoot, you can sell these for $4 and $4.50. And there were those great big buckles with a horseshoe on them. Uh-huh. Our horse. About that time, he pulls out this plastic bag, and it's got two spurs in it. He says, oh, by the way, drop that off the fellow in the office. Well, he did, and the fellow in the office took him out, and they're just as pretty as they can be. Shiny chrome with this chain and the little spur and these two little horse emblems. And it was for the girl behind the desk, so she put them on, and she took them off and spurred herself as she did. They all got tickled and started laughing. And then he looked at them, and they were silver with this gold emblem on each one. And he said, you know, he put one of the emblems on upside down. Look at this. You just wait till I get him in here. We're going to show him this. We went on back out to the tack truck, and Cookie's up in the truck. And down there on the bottom of the truck are two blankets, and then it looked like a lunge line out of red nylon with a pretty shiny hook. It would just go perfect with that red halter he had, and then a blue strap. And he says, those are mine. Put them in the truck. Yes, sir, Mr. Cook. Wrapped them up and took them over and dropped them in the truck. And shortly, Cookie comes back over and says, I tell you what, that's an awful crummy girth we got on that saddle. You know, he had that real fancy tulle leather saddle,
yeah,
with a high front and back.
Yeah.
And he said, let's put a blanket on there and put that girth on there, too. Just dress it up a little bit. So we put one of these fancy white blankets on. It had the yellow and black trim woven in, a little leather on the side, and that white girth with a blue stripe in it. And, oh, that just dressed the horse up so nice. And I'd get up there and sit in that saddle, and it would buck around a little bit. And I got to thinking, this saddle is so deep set and sculptured, there's no way the horse can get you off. Well, you just wrap your leg all around those things. And I'm beginning to see why he hangs onto that saddle. And I would just prance around, and this horse was looking just kingly, you know. And everybody else got these old, dull, untooled black leather saddles, and their equipment is kind of crummy and dirty. And Cookie just keeps smiling the whole time. And we brought him back and tied him up. And then a fellow drives up, and he says, Cookie, look at that. He's got California plates. He says, it don't mean a thing. I know that fella. He's the biggest scoundrel you've ever met. Well, he had a little old tiny narrow horse trailer, and he had a Pinto in there. And they hauled him out. And a fellow who brought in the big white trailer with the gooseneck walked over and picked up his tail and was like, he hadn't been cleaned much, has he? The man says, no, sir, he's right out of the woods. Cookie told me later, says, you know why I didn't buy that Pinto? I says, no. He says, because that horse has been to so many shows, so many auctions, and they can't get rid of him. And then he pointed to another one. You see that one there? I said, yeah. Now, that one's name is Stud. Faye will probably remember that. I used to own that horse. So there we're all congregated around with this couple trailers over here and that big truck full of ponies in the middle, and Cookie and I over under a shade tree with Sam, and this little girl came up and liked to ride him. Cookie said, sure, go ahead. And she got on, and I was amazed at what she made him do. Because when I got on, Cookie told me, give him loose rein and let him walk, see if he will. Well, I did, and he walked, except he wouldn't walk in a straight line.
Mm-hmm.
He kept going off to the left, right. And I finally got to where I pulled in the right rein and made it shorter than the left and held it over to one side, so he was constantly being neck reined on the right to bring him around, and you could get him in a fairly straight line, except he just speed up a little as he went. And pretty soon he was up to gallop, and I'd have to rear back on him. Well, this girl got on there, and he'd just walk. And he'd walk down the fence and stop, and she'd turn him around, and then he'd canter back and stop, and then he'd trot. I was just amazed. And Cookie leans over to me and says, you know, I think I'll let her show that horse. And I said, that's fine, Cookie.
That's when he started thinking how good a... Yeah.
And so she was there, and her sister and the mother, and the mother had one of these little cassette tape recorders that I guess he hadn't hooked up, so never ran it. And she didn't know a damn thing about horses and made the most awful idle talk about, oh, I just feel so sorry for those old horses. I just want to buy every one of them. And I was like, oh, Cookie, what are you hanging around these people for? Well, it turns out he was letting that little girl ride the horse all she wanted, and she fell in love with the horse, and he was figuring on selling the horse to him.
Sure.
And I was thinking beforehand why you don't want someone messing with the horse if there's something wrong with it, why they'll find out. Well, Cookie didn't care. Go on, ride the horse. Fall in love with it. Buy it. But it looked like, you know, there's just not too many people showed up, and the auction wasn't going to come off. And they left pretty soon, so Sam ended up tied up by the trailer again in the shade. And meanwhile, this big white horse had been traded to another fella who came in a pickup truck. Just had grid sideboards on his pickup, and those horses would jump in and jump out, and that old tailgate was just bent around the bumper from horses stepping under it. And he'd nailed a couple rubber doormats onto it and thrown hay in there. Cookie, look at that rig. That's the damnedest thing I've ever seen. It's just terrible, isn't it? And I said, it is. And I thought, well, really, that's no higher than stepping up into your trailer, Cookie. So they apparently traded that big white horse for a little pony. The guy with the white horse ended up with a pony. And I looked over, and he loaded up his trailer, and a couple of the other people loading off and leaving. But the man in the California truck was still there. He was wearing this bright yellow shirt and a little hat. And he was a good deal older than Cookie. And probably a lot more shrewd, or just about as shrewd as Cookie. And Cookie went in and talked to the fellow, and it looked like the auction wasn't going to come off. For horses, anyway. They were going to go ahead and sell the cars. And the tack people had just been dealing all day out of the back of their trucks. You know, they didn't do any auctioning, just, you know, selling good prices. So Cookie loaded up Sam, said, you don't have to take the saddle off him. But I went ahead and took it off, and took the bridle off and put the halter on and loaded him in, and we drove up. Only Cookie made sure he drove past the fella in the yellow shirt. And just as he gets by, he slows down and stops, says, well, I guess I'll be on my way. And he looks over, and the fella comes over and leans in the window and says, well, you didn't do much trading today, did you? No, what about you? So, oh, I got that white one. So, I said, how would you like to buy that horse? He said, what you asking? The man says, what you giving? Cookie says, what you asking? The man paused a minute. He says, 150. Well, the man that brought him only wanted 90, and Cookie knew that. Cookie says, 75. Oh, I can't do that. Make it 125. Cookie says, can't do that. 75. Man says, well, make it a quarter more than that. So no, I can't do that, says Cookie. He says, well, make it 110. 75. The man waited. I don't know, it's got to be 110. Cookie's just smoking a cigar, taking his time, you know, letting the smoke curl out of the end of the cigar there, and then he'd take another puff and look out the window and look around. So 85. No, I can't do that, it's got to be 110. Just let that lie. Cookie put it in gear and hedged forward a foot or two, and then the man started talking again. Cookie put on the brake, and he started talking a minute or two and shifted back into neutral. And the truck's just shaking and idling all the time, and Cookie still got his cigar. And the man says, you got any saddles for sale? Cookie says, no. Any other horses? No. How about a cow for that horse you got? You got any good cows? He says, you know, they're bringing 300 now. Cookie says, well, I'll tell you what I want to trade that horse for is money. Man waits a minute. He says, I don't know. They're good cows. Holsteins and nursing. Give milk. He says, nope. The man looks back in the back and he sees that saddle back there. A fancy saddle. He says, how about that saddle? Cookie says, what do you give me for it? And the man thinks a minute And he says, well, I could sell you a saddle. And a horse cooks says, wait a minute, right now, brother, it's coming my way. We're talking about that saddle in the back.
Oh.
What do you give me for it? The man says, oh, how about $40? Coogie says, yes, my fella. You just go and try and buy a saddle like that for $40. You just try and buy one. And the fella kind of backs off a little bit. How about $75? And says, I can't do that. So Cookie puts it in gear and edges on forward a couple more feet. And the fella says, you're the doctor. You know, you're the one that's letting it all go. And Cookie stops and takes it out of gear again. White horse to go for 110. Cookie says, nope, I've named my top dollar. He said, well, I could trade you something for that horse you got back there, a saddle. Cookie says, no. He says, well, how about a mule? You got any mules? Cookie says, I already sold my last one. But now I have got a horse. Good riding horse, 17 hands high. I only want $500 for it. I said, that's too much. That's too high in price and size. So that be it? Says, yeah, I reckon so, says Cookie. And he puts it in gear, and we eased on out. And Cookie looks over me and just smiles. I says, you got him, didn't you, Cookie? The man got stuck with that old white horse and didn't sell a thing. Now that made his day.
Uh-huh.
We had done a bit of trading all day, but just that one little bit.
Oh, that's all there was.
That was the best part.
But right that was enough for him. That was the tonic he needed.
That just pleased him. He drove out and says, well, I met some new people and didn't get much trading done. But I had a lot of fun. I don't have to sell that horse. I just take it home and let the kids ride it.
That's what he told me. You know, I'd say when he stopped, he said,
yeah.
We had a good time. We had a good time. And that little girl riding the horse gave him a notion of who else he might try to sell.
Yeah, she's got a pretty good horse there. It's a little moth-eaten right now. It needs to be filled out some. And he told that fella, he says, it's a little thin, just put some groceries in them. The guy says, uh-uh, they don't show it in 2 days, I turn them over. So they all must be like that. They don't want to hold on to that horse anytime at all. And I'm getting the notion, nobody really makes any money, they just keep exchanging horses.
Uh-huh.
And they've got these rigs, and they're all traders. And I just thought, my God, I thought Cookie was just one of a kind, and here's a whole group of them.
Yeah.
And you put them together, and they say, well, tell you what, I'll make it $110, and I'll tell you everything that's wrong with the horse.
Oh! that stuff.
Uh-oh, they're so honest with each other, you know. That old white horse is all those terrible, terrible looking spooned out feet, and it looked like somebody just clipped the tendons in the pastern so the thing could just swing forward. And it was all scaly. And so, well, he's just got a little water on it. You see, the rest of him's pretty good shape. That's just from stepping a little mud and water there. I'll be frank with you.
Well, now, if you hadn't been along there, well, then I would have pictured, you see, that he went to the livestock pavilion and they had a whole bunch of high-class horses coming in there. So you don't know what goes on equipment.
Mm-mm. He didn't have, there maybe have been 17 horses there. And there wasn't one that was really decent.
But of course, this is not really an auction. I mean, that
no,
you didn't see
him
go through.
No, it's the second time they tried to hold
them
there.
But as you say, you don't know what happens. But in his, he had a good time.
But he came back here and he said, yep, I had a good time. We didn't quite have enough horses to get an auction going, but I met some fellows and there was some trading going on. And I thought, wow, did we go to the same place?
Well, I tell you, it was just beautiful. Yes, he said, I'll open it up and let the horse come out. And that horse just bounced out.
Yeah.
And that little cocktail. And the horse looking all around, you see, wasn't paying attention to anything. With that pretty halter or whatever.
Oh,
horse,
yeah.
Had on.
It really helps when you had all that equipment.
And then you see when he got ready, that horse had bounced right back in. Well, I tell you, that's kind of what
he had, that saddle on him, and he had a chest strap, and then he had a ring going from the girth up to the...
As a tie-down he bought
tie-down,
from me.
Yeah. So every time a horse went to eat, it pulled him back. And he thought, wow, what a disciplined horse. And I thought, that's kind of a trick, isn't it, Cookie? He didn't say anything. And I looked over, and every other horse had one.
Oh, yeah.
Everybody did it.
That's what Pussy needs?
Well, and New Peach is so such a fine horse.
Yeah. This horse is not as big as Noopy is.
A lot shorter.
Probably wouldn't eat as much.
I don't think this one will ride quite as well as Noopy.
This one will cut cattle.
So he said.
Yeah. That little girl riding him, he might. Well, I wonder what she did. You didn't do.
She knew how to ride, for one thing.
Yeah. Well,
I don't see how they can say how old they are when anybody can tell that they're 5 or up to 12. You know, they can tell. They can say, but they.
Well, that little fellow had a 12-year-old horse. There's no use trying to lie. Because it looked 12 years old.
Yeah.
It looked 100 years old.
Yeah.
And the others looked like they'd been reincarnated or something.
Uh-huh.
General Duova, I don't know, around 1500, and this is in the Rick's report, Debbie's report, and Rick's report. This Saturday night, 27th January, 73. Mamu ought to have been here to hear it. Mamu should have heard it. Channel 2 over, around 1500, I'm guessing. End of Rick's report, and Debbie's just before it. This Saturday, the 27th of January, 73. This channel went over around 1500, and Debbie reports this Saturday after supper, the 29th of January, 73. Debbie reports on Tufts again. Debbie reports on Tufts again. Channel 2 around 1500, Saturday, Monday after supper, the 29th of January, 73. Rick reported, but it didn't get on this tape.
I'm trying to get started on something. I've got to get through that chatter. You think anybody that reads well, I think, figures that someday they might be a writer. You think it's any more than that?
Well, it is for me.
When you were younger.
When I was younger.
You said way back you had that in mind.
Yes, I always have. All the time. I when I talk about why I like to write, it's pretty abstract because it's a pretty abstract feeling that I have when I write. But the reason that I like to write is because it's the only thing that makes the world ordered. It's all an idea of order for me. That it makes things coherent and ordered if I write about them. And it's always been that way. And,
Well, that's all I mean by taking things to the typewriter.
Yeah, exactly.
Basically.
So when I say I want to be a writer or I want to write, everybody immediately says, well, what, are you going to write novels? Or, I was telling Guy this afternoon, I actually sat down a year and a half ago and I was going to write a novel. When I think about it today, I just want to say, it tickles me in the ribs, I think it's so funny, but I actually sat down one day in front of a typewriter and wrote the first chapter of a novel. I actually did it.
Well, what I said was she might have got away with it.
Sure.
She might have. The demur I have is that the mortality is so high, so few get away with it. It kills them off. Mostly it'll kill them off. They can't make it. So I have, if you can make it, go ahead. You don't have to try, unless it kills you off.
Well, I didn't get any farther than the first chapter.
Well, you might have. Yeah.
It killed me pretty quick. I sat there all afternoon, and at the end of the afternoon, I just...
Well, the thing I told Debbie, the thing that made me wise, that she had... She didn't somehow decide not to go to graduate school. Now, that was early, too. That wasn't just in your senior year.
No, I guess, well, it sort of came to a head then, because I had a tutor when I was a senior, and he kept telling me that I should go on to graduate school. And I said, well, no, I wasn't going to do it, that I wanted to see the world, and I wasn't going to go to graduate school, and I didn't, and I guess for pretty much the whole time I was in college, I had a very strong feeling that I didn't want to go on writing papers about Samson. I guess that, when I did that, I should have known. I just wasn't cut out for it.
Well, you landed at this little 2x4 public relations office at Tufts.
Yeah.
About as unlikely a place as I could, from from listening to you talking about it, as unlikely a place as you'd find to anything to happen that would be interested at all. How'd you land there, Debbie?
Well, I went up to Boston. I actually went up to Boston just to visit Candy, and then I was going to go to New York. I was really going to do this tackling the world in a big way. I was going to go to New York City, and I went to Boston instead, and I just decided to look for a job, and I decided I liked Boston. In a week, I decided I liked Boston. It was less than that. It was about 3 days. I decided I liked it enough to stay. So I just I called universities, actually, because the only job I'd ever had was here at the university, working at the hospital. I called.
Oh, yeah.
I worked when I was in college here. I was working there that first summer. I used to come out here. And every summer after that, I worked there. And so I called Tufts. I called Harvard, and I called Tufts, and I called BU, and I called all the universities around Boston. And Tufts gave me an interview. So I went trotting out to Medford, and it was so far out, and I didn't know how to use the subways or the buses or anything, so I was about an hour late for my interview. But it didn't matter, because it was just a big employment office anyway. And I sort of walked in, and she said, well, what do you want to do? And I said, oh, I want to work in hospital public relations. Like it's some big career goal to work in hospital public relations. You'd be surprised. There are all kinds of organizations for people who run hospital public relations offices. But anyway, it's quite a little field. And I said, what do you have in that? And she said, well, as a matter of fact, there's an opening. And I said, oh, well, I'll interview for it right away. And she called up down in Boston. The medical school was down in Boston, not out in Medford, and where the rest of the university was. So I went down and interviewed, and I just walked in and slapped my resume down on the desk. Told Max Elder that I knew all about hospital public relations, but I didn't know anything. And I had written a news story before. I'd written about 3 of them. And so I told him I'd written news stories, and he believed me, fool, and hired me. And there I was. Right on.
Partly it was kind of what made a go of it there was Marcia.
Yes, we were just talking a little bit about Marcia today, and Marcia looked at everything in the fact that she made a caricature of it. I mean, it's she was looking at it while she was talking about it, while she was looking at all the ethnic groups in Boston or looking at the people around the hospital, and she made funny characters out of them, but at the same time she looked at them enough to see that they were funny characters or to find something in them that she could use to describe them, so that she had a view of Tufts and of our office that worked, that was looking at them enough to say, well, Robert Anderson has a three-piece suit mentality. That's what we used to say about Robert Anderson, because he was one of the little administrators that wore a three-piece suit all the time, you know, with a vest and a jacket, and they all matched, all these little tweedy suits. And he had all his little degrees. He had about 6 degrees in hospital administration, and they were up all around his office, framed. And he would talk to you about hospital administration when you went in. Well, that's all right, but Robert Anderson used to carry it a little bit too far, because what he was in charge of was supplies, in other words, the Q-tips. And he made such a, which is all right too. I mean, it's fine for him to make a big deal out of his job, but when Marcia looked at it, she came out with the three-piece suit mentality of Robert Anderson, which is just a way of looking at it.
Well, she did that all by herself.
Mm-hmm. She, well, we all joined in. You know, when we talk in the office, we'd all sort of join in about it. And then, of course, we had such people working in our office that.
Yeah. Well, now that.
We had plenty of material right there.
That cynic side of Marcia left its mark on you. You still give people a little labels.
Now?
Hmm.
Well, I don't know. I don't know whether I do. I don't see it.
Now those little labels that Marcia has may stand in between you and Miss Mary.
Well, I don't. Maybe they do. I don't think so, because I don't think of Miss Mary with little labels. I mean, I look at Miss Mary and Mr. Weaver in awe. I don't look at them with labels. That's part of the thing that stands between me and Mr. Weaver and Miss Mary. I'm in awe of them. Seriously.
Mm-hmm.
That's a real problem for me.
You just haven't lived in that world before.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I just said it.
Mm-hmm. I can see what you mean.
I just said it. You see, I don't have that. I don't do that at all, and I never did. That's that type of mentality that Mark has. That's what I say, though, but she did it herself, and it was an effort to. Now, did she have your literary background?
Yeah. She was an English major. But she was in.
I don't find it that English majors have that much of a literary background. Sometimes the physics majors are better and better readers.
Mm-hmm.
I actually don't find it. You see, Jane gets out here and she gets stuck with a course and reads 6 of Defoe's novels. But Jane can't talk about books anyhow. She can talk about everything else, but she hadn't learned to talk about books.
And I would have worked with her a little on those things, you see. But she's ahead of me now. She's got north of Fry. So that's what, that is, that stands between me and Jean. Well, now, you didn't see the UPI man through Marsha's eyes.
No, that I saw myself, because he was actually hired after I was. I was hired in a great onslaught of hiring by Mr. Elder. They hired him as director of the office, and then they gave him a big budget, and they told him that he could hire as many people as he wanted to get the job done. They went on this public relations rampage, which lasted 2 years, and then they cut the budget 50% because they decided that his program wasn't any good, which is what happens in public relations, I guess. But he hired me, and then he hired another, then he hired Selby, and then he hired John Hahn. John Hahn came to us from UPI. He had worked for about 35 or 40 years for UPI, and his health wasn't too good, and so he had to get a less demanding job, and he came to Tufts, which was really a shame, because he always got, they used to stick the ladies' auxiliary on him. He was the news editor. He was a really fine newspaper man. He'd worked all these years for UPI, and he was a really fine newspaper man. I mean, he would turn out a news story in 5 minutes. You just say three things, and he'd have a beautiful news story. I mean, he was a fine, fine writer. But he came to Tufts, and he got the ladies' auxiliary. You know, Mrs. Lewis Weinstein would come in her mink coat and yell at him, because he hadn't gotten a three-column spread on her in the Newton Graphic, and. He just couldn't cope with these women, because he was sort of a shy man anyway, and terribly, terribly organized. Just anything you did to upset his routine would throw him for a week. One thing we used to do, we'd always go out, if somebody had a birthday, we'd have a big party for everybody in the office, and we usually would go out for lunch or something during the day, or sometimes we'd go out at night for dinner. Well, if we went out for dinner, That was just ideal for John, because he could plan for 2 weeks how he was going to get everybody into the cars, and how he was going to get the cars wherever it was we were going, where he was going to park the cars, and then how we were all going to get home afterwards, and which route he would take to get us home. You know, how he would go down Star Drive to Kenmore Square and get off there to take me to Brookline, and then he would cut back on Park Drive and get back on Star Drive and go across the such and such a bridge to get to Cambridge to take Marion home, but he would take this road to get around Harvard Square so that he could go under the underpass and miss the traffic. He had this thing for traffic. He wanted to stay far away from traffic. And he used to come into the office. He was always the first one in the morning. It really upset him if someone else got in before he did. Well, he'd leave his house at 6 o'clock in the morning, so of course he'd be the first one in the office. And we decided that the reason he liked to be in so early was all his years working for UPI, when he used to work all night and have odd shifts and things like that. And he'd listen to the traffic report on the radio or television, and then he would plan when he would leave his house in Hingham, which is on the South Shore about 35 minutes from Boston, when he would leave in order to miss most of the traffic to get into the office by 6:45, so that he'd be the first one there and could make the coffee in the morning in the Victoria coffee machine, which was one of the bones of contention in the office for about 6 months. We used to have office meetings every week on Fridays usually, and we'd meet for a couple hours, and all we'd do would be discuss the coffee situation. It was like the world's crisis, you know, what are we going to do with this coffee machine? Has everybody paid their $3.50 this month? And whoever it was to whom it fell to collect the money was certainly the hated member. For a while, Marsha did it for a while And then I got to do it for a while, and I used to leave memos around. That was a carryover from John, because John used to leave memos all the time for everybody. We had memo stationery, and John would write you a memo if you'd gotten a phone call while you were gone. He couldn't use the little office pink pads that most people use to say, you know, while you were out, so-and-so called. John would write you a memo about it on a big sheet of paper if he happened to answer the phone while you were out. And the real reason that John got started on memos was because of Donut Day. And John, it was really very nice how
Donut
John...
Day.
John got started on Donut Day because, well, we all used to eat breakfast in the office. We just, when we got in, there'd be coffee, and we'd have some kind of donut or cake or something. I used to make that lemon cake that Faye makes all the time and take it in. And John wanted to do something too, which was really nice. But he didn't bake, and so he said one week, he said, well, I think what I'll do is I'll stop at Dunkin' Donuts or Mr. Donut, I guess. I think it was Mr. Donut, finally. He decided that Mr. Donut's donuts were better than Dunkin' Donuts. He did a survey. And so he stopped and brought in a dozen donuts. And then the next week he did the same thing on Friday. And he said that by the third week, it was Donut Day on Friday. And for 2 years, we had Donut Day every week. Now, usually Donut Day was on Friday, but sometimes if he'd come around and he'd check with you, he'd start reminding you on Thursday morning, he'd come around to everybody's desk and he'd say, he stammered a little bit, and he'd say, you know, tomorrow's Donut Day, he'd say. And then by the afternoon, he was going around taking your order, your donut order for the next morning. You know, you want another apple and spice, he'd say. Or buttermilk?
Oh, dang.
Well, we all learned pretty quick that you don't change your order with John. See, if you changed your donut order, you'd have thrown him for 6 months. He couldn't cope with any kind of change in his routine. It would have been as bad if I'd asked him to drive down Memorial Drive instead of Star Drive to take me home or something some night. So we all ate the same kind of donuts all the time because he couldn't stand this change. Well, that was all right, except for Mr. Elder, who was our boss. And John had a real thing about status in the office, which I think was also a carryover from UPI. And he just couldn't approach Mr. Elder. He couldn't talk to him. And we used to just sort of walk in and out and talk to him all the time and say whatever we pleased. And, you know, we paid him no respect at all as the head of the office, absolutely none. We used to call him leader because some mail came for him one time addressed to Mr. Max Leader instead of Mr. Max Elder, his name was. And so we called him leader and were sort of flip with him. And he didn't mind. He liked it. But John couldn't do that. John couldn't even approach him to ask him for his donut order. And what happened was the first couple weeks that the donuts came in, John happened to buy chocolate donuts, which are chocolate dough with icing on top, which at 8 o'clock in the morning is pretty hard to face. A chocolate donut is your entire breakfast. Well, Mr. Elder ate this chocolate donut 2 weeks in a row, and he was stuck for the rest of the year with chocolate donuts. There's nothing he could do to change the donut order unless he happened to go back into the back room where the coffee was and be lucky enough to get there in time to take somebody else's donut. Usually he didn't have time to do that. He was making phone calls or something or ready to leave or go out right away. So he'd just have to have his donut brought to him, and it was always a chocolate donut. Well, I remember one morning about a year after he'd been eating chocolate donuts, I went in, he was on the phone or something, and so I was taking him a cup of coffee, and his donut, it never occurred to me that he didn't like chocolate donuts, and I put down this chocolate donut in front of him, and he looked at it, and he just sort of went, oh, and then he looked at me, and he said, you know, I really hate chocolate donuts. That was John's great contribution to our office was Donut Day. Oh, and the weather report. John was fascinated with weather. We should have him here. He would be having such a good time with this freeze we're going to have tonight. He used to come in and tell us what the temperature was. We'd walk in the door and he would greet us in the morning, 8:30 in the morning, with what the temperature was on Tremont Street. He'd say, it's 8 degrees on Tremont Street, but with the chill factor. Now, you know what the chill factor is? It's the chill factor is when the wind velocity makes it colder than it really is, and then he'd explain that on Tremont Street the buildings are a little higher, so it makes a wind tunnel, so it's even colder than it is on the common, which is three blocks away. And he would say, now, this morning it's 8 degrees outside, but with the chill factor it's really 25 below zero. And we'd all just sort of go, oh, and pull our coats around us and not want to go out again all day.
Now, how did we bring in the girl that had martini?
That was John's girlfriend in the office. She wasn't really his girlfriend, but Marion.
Yes.
Marion and John were terribly good friends. And They used to have lunch together every day. They'd go down and eat lunch in the little short order cafe in the hotel, and they'd come back and John would give us a full report on what they'd had for lunch. He'd spend 10 minutes telling us the quality of the corn chowder for that day, or how good the cheese and bacon and tomato sandwiches were that day. So, you know, we'd know whether we wanted to eat downstairs or go someplace else. But Marion would very happily eat with John, you know, every day. But Marion had a boyfriend, and Marion's boyfriend would call her up at about 11 o'clock, and he'd say, you know, well, let's go to lunch at 12. And this was sort of, this really upset John, that she would just drop everything and go to lunch with this boyfriend. Well, part of the reason that Marion liked to go to lunch so much with this boyfriend was that the boyfriend took her. They always went to the same place, and they always sat in the same table, at the same table. And she always said she was going to let somebody go with her on her lunch with her boyfriend, but she never did. She never took any of us with her. But the reason she liked to go was that they served all their drinks in water glasses, like that green water glass over there, an 8 or 10 ounce water glass.
Oh, my.
Well, Marion used to get martinis.
Oh, no.
In glasses like that. I mean, that's 10 ounces of martini, she'd have two. And then she'd come back to the office. Well, she'd be so drunk, she couldn't walk straight. I swear to God, I saw her weaving down Tremont Street, dodging the cars. She couldn't walk. And it used to just upset John no end, because she'd come into the office and she'd always do her work. She could always type or proofread or do whatever it was she was supposed to be doing, but she'd talk to you and she wouldn't remember what she'd said. And 5 minutes later, she'd come back and she'd ask you the same question. Or if she answered the phone, it was just a disaster area, because she'd punch the wrong buttons. She could never remember which button to punch on the phone anyway. She couldn't quite work the hold button on office phones. You know, you have four little buttons and a red button on the end where you put somebody on hold. Well, Marion just couldn't work the hold button. She'd get a call on one line, and she'd hold the phone out like this and yell for whoever it was that had the call, you know, just yell as loud as she could. And we'd say, Marion, just punch the hold button, and she'd never be able to do it. She couldn't cope with the hold button. But John used to get really mad at her when she'd come back drunk, and he'd just yell and scream at her. And he'd just get furious because she wouldn't understand anything he was telling her. And it was all right, because she wouldn't remember it the next day, and he'd be so embarrassed he wouldn't bring it up again, and they'd be perfect friends again the next morning, but because she wouldn't remember. She never remembered anything that went on when she was drunk. But she could type, and she never made any mistakes. And she could proofread, and she never made any mistakes. But she couldn't function any other way.
Russell proofreads, Faye.
Yes, she said.
And she's an expert.
She is. She said on her tape, she was at one point, she really did well with that tape. She sent me, she talked for a solid hour, and she didn't interrupt it or anything. But at one point, she stopped and said, you know, I think what I ought to do is go back through this tape and correct all the grammar. I'm splitting my infinitives. And see, she knows all that kind of stuff. She took a course.
Well, now, you know, in a way, you see, if you report on John and what's her name?
Marion.
That's just sort of what's visible about him, and it's just sort of superficial. Maybe something that it may not, more likely than not. But if you listen to them and let them report, then they'll interpret themselves. But then your handling of it will be different.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow or other, you see, there ought to be room for both in the same report, in the same piece, you know. Now you see, I can't get over the fact that one of my old